Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by Dr. Bruce Gordon, the Titus Street Professor of Ecclesiastical History at Yale University, and author of a new biography out this month with Yale University Press titled Zwingli, God's Armed Prophet. Bruce, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Zach. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, Bruce, before we discuss the book, can you tell our listeners some about your background and what you've written in the past?
Sure. I grew up in Canada, the western prairies of Canada, and then studied for many years in Nova Scotia on the East Coast, made my way across the Atlantic to Scotland, St. Andrews, where I did my PhD, and during that time spent a lot of time in Switzerland. I went back to, after I finished my PhD, went back to Scotland and then spent a few years in Germany and back in Canada and then back in Scotland again, where I taught for 15 years in the Department of History at St. Andrews before coming in 2008 to Yale, where I've been married with a daughter who's now 23, and we live in New Haven. So.
Very good. Well, as we turn to the book now, I'd like to invite you just to walk us through the book, introduce us to Zwingli and mm-hmm. to some of the themes and mm-hmm. cast of characters that appear here in the book.
Sure. Zwingli will probably be less familiar to many people who know about the Reformation, not nearly as well known as Luther or Calvin, some of the other figures, but he is extremely important for a number of reasons. He's an exact contemporary of Martin Luther, so that he's born in the next year from Martin Luther, so they're almost exactly the same age. He's born in Switzerland, in a peasant, really in an alpine valley. He is a very prodigious young man who gets a very good education and becomes one of the most well-educated humanists of his time, which meant that he studied Greek and then later Hebrew, classical literature of both Greece and Rome. He was heavily influenced by the great humanist Erasmus. He becomes a priest, and while he's a priest, he accompanies the Swiss mercenaries, the soldiers who were hired by the papacy and the King of France down into Italy. This is around the year 1515, the great Battle of Marignano. Zwingli is there. He's not a soldier, but he's there as a priest with the soldiers. And these wars in Italy are a terrible massacre. And the mercenary service plays a huge role in Zwingli's life. He's deeply disillusioned, shocked really by his experience in war. And he starts to see the mercenary service, which is so crucial for the Swiss in this period. Switzerland is not, as we imagine it now, a very wealthy country in the 16th. It was very poor, alpine, struggling, subsistence farming, a number of cities, but certainly not an area of anything like the wealth that we would associate it now. And one of the ways for these poor areas of the country to survive was for young men to enter into mercenary service for foreign leaders, King of France, the Pope, various others. And Zwingli came to see this mercenary service as a moral catastrophe. It was destroying the land. Most of these young men were dying and never coming back. The money that was flowing into the country to recruit these was leading to political corruption and what he saw as moral turpitude. So he comes out of this world and he has a kind of conversion experience as a priest. He's being very close to Erasmus. He embraces this idea that the Bible alone is authoritative, and that it's crucial to learn Latin and Greek to be able to understand the Bible. So he's highly educated, but he has a conversion experience around the year 1516, which is before he really knows about Martin Luther. So he has this experience on his own. He wants to become a priest who is engaged in reform. He begins to preach from the Bible. He begins this, what will be a journey towards a new religious vision. And this is what's important about Zwingli. He goes to the city of Zurich. After a few years, he introduces the Reformation. And he introduces a completely new vision of what the Christian community and what the Christian church should be. It's really the beginning point of what becomes known as the Reformed tradition of Christianity, sometimes called Calvinism because of John Calvin, who comes later, but I think more appropriately called the Reformed tradition. We tend to look back to Calvin and Geneva as the beginning point of this, but Calvin inherited this tradition. He's of the next generation. He inherited this tradition from Zwingli. In Zurich. So this Zwingli is a very creative spirit. He envisages this idea of what church and society can look like. And so although he's less well known, he is really the beginner or the founder of a whole branch of Christianity. We can talk about this. He is a very controversial figure. He is a very controversial preacher. He gets involved in politics. He gets involved in the wider politics of the Swiss Confederation, which eventually leads to war. And he has attitudes that actually embrace war as a necessary part of religious reform. And most spectacularly, he dies in battle in 1531. And that's one of the reasons why his legacy is so deeply problematic.
Well, Bruce, that's a helpful kind of overview of Zwingli's life. And, you know, one of the unique things about the book is how you're sort of unpicking these different layers of Zwingli and how he could be actually a pretty complicated person and hold different beliefs, sometimes in tension, if not in conflict. So that's one of the good things I think that comes out in the book. You know, it's also great how you're drawing on Zwingli and these different relationships he has with different people here in the book. So just following up on sort of that overview, I want to ask about his relationship with Martin Luther. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Zwingli's relationship with Luther, it's almost always going to come up in any talk about Zwingli. Mm-hmm. And you tell us in the book that retelling that relationship, it even has its own history. Mm-hmm. So you have some people who will say Zwingli's, you know, building on Luther, others he's independent of Luther. Why is the narrative between or the narrative of Luther and Zwingli more complicated than?
Well, I mean, to make a long story short, for Luther, Zwingli was the great demon. He was the most dangerous opponent that he faced, and he refused really any opportunity to be reconciled with Zwingli, because he thought that Zwingli had, beyond any form of reconciliation, distorted Christianity. This is a story that begins, though, much earlier. As I said before, they're almost exactly the same age. They have very different lives. Luther becomes the monk. He goes through a severe spiritual crisis. He becomes a professor at the University of Wittenberg. He has the dramatic story of the 95 Theses. And then becomes the great villain of the papacy. In response, he sees the papacy as Antichrist. So there's this spectacular battle around Luther. And Luther, of course, is associated with the great and central ideas of the Reformation: justification by faith alone, scripture alone, Christ alone, grace alone, these ideas. So Luther is, and in the German-speaking world, the Reformation is Martin Luther, and that remains the case to this day. The Reformation is almost entirely defined by the figure of Martin Luther. Dominant, the anniversary of the Reformation 2017 in German lands was all about Luther. Nobody else was really a very significant player in the story. So there is this idea that for German Lutheranism and for Germans as a whole, that the Reformation is all about Martin Luther. And that idea has not only in Germany, but beyond, been very much the sense that Luther is the Reformation. Well, Zwingli is a complication in that story because, as I mentioned before, he goes to the city of Zurich. He creates a different form of Christianity from Luther, which has different aspects to it. One of them is that Zwingli creates a vision of the Christian community where the political authorities and the religious authorities are as one, so that that the political community, the whole community, is also the church. He has a vision of Reformation, which embraces many of Luther's ideas, such as justification by faith alone, scripture alone, Christ alone. On these points, they're very much in agreement. But they look at the Bible and on significant issues see very different things, most notably around the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And this is a complicated story with a very long history, as you say, Zach. It continues for centuries, a sort of division between Reformed Christianity and Lutheran Christianity, and even within those two camps, divisions. But essentially, it comes down to a question of this. When Christ says, "This is my body, this is my blood," the Catholic doctrine was that in the Mass, the bread and wine really become, really physically become the body and blood of Christ. Christ is physically present at the sacrament. Luther criticizes this, but he still wants to have a notion of the sacrament in which Christ is present. Many of his critics say that he still sails very closely to the Catholic position. Zwingli, following on from his great mentor, Erasmus, uses sort of Pauline language, which divides much more strictly what he sees as flesh and spirit, body and spirit. And that is that, so therefore, that the sacrament must be entirely spiritual. Christ cannot be physically present because, as the creed says, he has ascended into heaven and sits on the right hand of the Father. His body is no longer in the world. So that the sacrament is about the spiritual feeding of the faithful. It cannot in any way be about a real presence of the body. That seems like an arcane distinction, which is, you know, often difficult to understand, but it really stands behind two quite different views of how God is present in the world. And that question got tied up with a whole lot of politics in the Holy Roman Empire and in the Swiss Confederation. And so the story is not simply theological, it's political, but it's also deeply personal. Luther saw Zwingli as a threat. They both saw themselves as prophets. As we know, prophets don't tend to get along with each other very well. If one is a prophet, the other ones tend to be false prophets in their eyes. And that was certainly how Luther regarded Zwingli. He thought that Zwingli had corrupted the reading of the Bible, had corrupted the sacraments. He called Zwingli and his followers fanatics. And he had, there could be no communion with him. He would not reconcile. They did meet in 1529 at a conference in which they agreed between the parties on a lot of theological issues, but they did not agree on the Lord's Supper. So the Lord's Supper became a symbol of the splitting of the Reformation into various parties, the Lutherans, the Reformed. And so the Lord's Supper not only is a theological question, it becomes a kind of physical symbol of how the Reformation broke apart really in its earliest years, and how reformers could look at the Bible, which they said, you know, was the truth, and that the Bible interprets itself, but yet when they looked at it, they saw two very different things, and that's precisely what their Catholic opponents said of them, that theirs was just a divided house of chaos, which was proof that they were all heretics. You mentioned the afterlife of this. The book is very interested in how those divisions and carry on long after Luther and Zwingli are dead. They define a large part of Protestant culture, not only in Europe, but in the Americas and beyond, notions of religious identities, the way in which they continued to be tied up in politics. And there is to this day still differences between the ways in which reformers or that those who are in Protestant communities view the sacraments. So the debate has a long history, but it's tied up in a whole range of other issues, as it was for both Luther and Zwingli. It was personal, it was political, it was theological, and you can't separate any of these things up. They were two very, very different people, and it's unlikely that they ever really would have seen eye to eye. But the consequences of their fight with one another was disastrous for the Reformation. It split it at a time when it would have had a chance to have been a much more successful movement than it was, but the Reformation fragmented, and that is part of what is the tragedy of the early years of that movement.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's really helpful, Bruce. I appreciate it. You know, another fascinating feature of the book, something that stuck out to me, was how you're describing Zwingli and his writing and his thinking.
Yeah.
You say, you know, he lacked a bit of organization. You tell us that he appreciated the classical authors, that he could be poetic. He was convictional, but would follow those convictions a bit chaotically or rather than systematically. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on Zwingli in this respect, and maybe tell us how does he relate to, you know, some of these classical authors, mm-hmm. and maybe how they shape his approach to matters that were important to him.
Sure. As I mentioned before, he's extremely well educated. He studies at university. He has a master's in the arts. He also studies theology. He's also a serious autodidact. We know from his early years as a priest, he was collecting books, and we have his notes in the books, so that we know that he was carefully reading the works of Greek and Roman authors. He was reading the works of medieval theologians. He was reading contemporary works, particularly, as I mentioned before, the great Erasmus, who is an enormous inspiration of this model of how the classical and the Christian can be brought together, that they are reconcilable. It's not a case of pagan and Christian, but that God actually worked through the classical world, although they may not have known Christ or have known God in the Christian or Jewish way, but that there is wisdom in the classical world that is inherited by the Christian. And so that's how Zwingli viewed himself and the world, that classical education was a way of reforming the world. And that's one of the, you asked about Luther and Zwingli, one of the differences that marks out Zwingli and the kind of formation of the Reformed tradition is this huge optimism that the world itself can be reformed, that the church can be reformed, and that education is a motor of change. The long tradition of Reformed Christianity and education, the building of schools and universities and academies, comes out of this conviction that Zwingli has, that education will make the world more godlike, not perfect, but that it will transform so that the Christian life can be one of learning and of piety. And these are not separate things. They belong together. So this is one of his motivating convictions. And you say he was not only deeply learned, he was a poet. He was a great writer of music. He performed Greek plays in Zurich after he was a reformer, and he even wrote the music for them. He edited works of Greek poets. He loved literature. He loved the study of history. He loved music. He was a very talented musician. He played many instruments. But the other thing is, you know, the slightly sort of chaotic side, that's something we need to remember, that these reformers did not just sit in a study and write works of theology. Zwingli never had time for that. He arrives in Zurich in 1519. In 1531, he's dead. He writes an enormous amount during those 12 years. The, you know, editions of his work run to many, many volumes. How did he do this? He did it at great speed, often staying up most of the night to write so that he could get the work to the publisher the next morning. But almost all of his writing is responding to the kind of maelstrom of events that are happening, most of which outside his control, opponents writing against him, political events that are happening, revolts like the Peasants' War, or the growth of a dissident movement who become known as the Anabaptists, who were close friends of his but end up rejecting him. So there's constant conflict, to say nothing of Luther and the sacraments and the poisonous relations with the Lutherans in Germany. There are communities spreading across Switzerland into Italy, into France, and north into Germany who are following Zwingli's theology. So they're constantly asking him questions. So he's constantly writing letters. We know from his own account that he stays up all night practically writing letters to all the people who want to hear from him. He exists within these networks of correspondence. So basically, he's working flat out for 12 years. And the theologies he writes are rarely simply what we might call systematic works that he could spend lots of time working through. They're often polemical, they're often written very quickly, and we're seeing his thought forming as the years go past. We're seeing his ideas taking shape, but they're all taking shape in the kind of fires of conflict and polemic and changing situations and social unrest and all the things that the Reformation brings in the 1520s. And that's what I try and do in this book, is to see that there are many different things happening at the same time. It's not just about reformers writing works of theology and these ideas being implemented. This movement was in many ways out of control, and nobody knew where it was going. The Reformation was not obvious. It was not obvious it was going to succeed. It's a very chaotic movement. And Zwingli is a good way for us to see how it was a movement that was constantly in flux.
That's really helpful, Bruce. Another question I have here as we're starting to wrap up is about what present conversations we could have as a result of, you know, reading a book like this. The book has value for how we can think about things, like human agency. You mentioned change, conflict, even a personality like Zwingli. What do you expect there as far as how your readers may receive this book?
Well, I mean, perhaps we could start with his end. He dies in battle. He goes into a battle dressed in armor. There's a nighttime ambush. He's killed. His body is cut into four by the Catholic forces. He's given a ritual trial as a heretic, and then the body is burnt. So there's no body. There's no funeral for him. The whole thing almost collapses after he's dead. And one of the things the book is about the role of violence and religion, and in many ways about how the Reformation is not just a nice story of Martin Luther nailing 95 theses to the door, and then the evil Catholics and the Protestants who kind of save Christianity, which is something of the story I grew up with. It's about the complexities of reform in this period, and showing that many Catholics were in favor of reform. Those who are called Anabaptists were visionaries of reform. Zwingli had his notion. There are contesting notions of what reform should be. But that brings up the question of who is right and who is going to enforce that position. Zwingli ties church reform very closely to political authority, and he's able to use that political authority to have military authority to enforce this. It all goes badly wrong and he dies, but it leaves us to think in 2021 about questions relating to coercion and force and religion, to think about how the Reformation has at its roots a considerable amount of violence, to consider questions of coercion. Why is it that the Anabaptists, 2 years after the Reformation is implemented in Zurich in 1525. In 1527, Anabaptists, those who oppose, who are Protestants who opposed Zwingli, are being put to death. So the persecuted have become the persecuting church, and that's Protestantism. So the story is more complex. And I think, in 2019 was the anniversary of Zwingli, and there were various events in Zurich and Switzerland and across the world, which really is, how does a modern secular society remember a highly religious and contentious event from 500 years ago? I think the story offers us a lot to think about the place of religion in society and the complicated world of religious change.
Well, Bruce, you've been generous with your time now. It's been a real pleasure to hear from you about the book. Maybe before we go, though, can you tell our listeners about what writing projects you may have next, what we can look out for?
Well, I have a big project which sort of moves away from the Swiss Reformation and from Zwingli and moves away in part from the Reformation. I'm writing a book called The Bible, A Global History, which looks at the Bible from when it emerges as a book, sort of around the 4th and 5th centuries, and its journey through many different cultures to our own time. So across when it becomes a book really of the whole world. And so it's about the many lives of a Bible over more than 1500 years. So
good. Well, I'm looking out for that, and it'd be great to maybe talk about that book in the future on New Books Network. For now, though, thank you for writing this book, Zwingli, God's Armed Prophet. It's out now with Yale University Press. And Bruce, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much for asking me.
And thank you all for listening. I'll see you next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network.